From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am Hunter Deusing in Dallas, Texas. Joining me in the wild Aboriginal outback of Australia is Mr. Stuart Balk. Say hello, Stu.
Odin were robbed of a big career.
We gotta chant it to bring him back. Odin! 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 Odin!
Now, please.
He's the next David Lee Roth.
Yeah.
Hey, that one guy, that guitar player, went on to be an Armored Saint. That's something, right? So, and joining me in the Rocky Mountain High of Colorado, Mr. John Grace.
Howdy.
Okay.
So, last week we talked about the decline of Western civilization, which was about punk in LA. This week we're talking about decline of Western civilization part two, the Metal Years, made almost 10 years later. 1988, Penelope Spheris directing. It's about LA again, but this is hair metal. Yeah. And it features such acts as Lizzie Borden, Faster Pussycat, Seduce, who? London, Odin, again, who? I don't know. Not from Norway. And Megadeth. Okay, we know them. And you got interviews from members of Aerosmith. You got Alice Cooper interviewed, Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley from Kiss, Lemmy from Motorhead, Ozzy Osbourne, yeah. And most memorably, Chris Holmes from Wasp.
Which was totally, as you read up on it, was totally faked.
Oh, it was totally faked. It didn't prevent Blackie Lawless from being pissed.
Yeah.
Well, no, it doesn't take much to get
pissed
off. If
I was Blackie Lawless, I would have been furious.
I'd say, you know what, Hunter? I'd say Chris Holmes's drunkenness in this film is equivalent to yours when we did the Star Wars episode.
I wasn't shouting about how I'm a piece of crap, though.
Oh, you were. I just said it all out. You didn't hear it, and you don't remember it.
Oh, right. Yeah, that was pretty bad. That was my drunk in the pool moment.
Yeah.
Now, luckily, I didn't record an impromptu Black Panther show.
Yeah.
But, you know, impromptu date nights with the wife, you tend to see stuff you're not really crazy about seeing, but you just, whatever. It's a movie.
So is the next kid going to be named Wakanda?
No.
No.
No, I just... Grace? You know, it was... the funny thing about that whole thing of Wakanda is that name was coined by Edgar Rice Burroughs, the creator of Tarzan. So everybody's going crazy over this thing coined by an author they all hate.
Nice try, colonizer.
Yeah. Oh, God. There's a lot of that in the movie, too. Colonizer used as a slur.
There's a meme running around. I can't remember who posted it. Might have been Garrow, I think, where it said... It showed a picture of black school children and said, 6 years from now, every kid will be named Wakanda.
Wakanda Williams.
Yeah, you wait. Although, I tell you this, Michael B. Jordan was great as the villain. Best Marvel villain of all those Marvel... I mean, Marvel movies are pretty weak on villains anyway, but he was terrific.
Yeah, normally, Marvel movies, where they suck is the villain sucks.
Yeah.
But Killmonger was good. He was good.
Yeah, that he's an actor that after Creed we were told he's going to be the next big thing and it hasn't really happened, but here it is, one of those examples like, well, why hasn't he become the next big thing? He's great in this. He's a great villain.
Has it been nominated for Best Picture? Because that, as we record right now,
no.
The shit pedophile Academy Awards are on, so just wondering if it's
no, it has not.
Oh,
it
okay, not. Amazing.
I think Get Out is. Currently sitting in the, you know, that category, I think.
Of the highly favored underdog winner, because Garrow predicted that to be the winner.
What the hell is Get Out? I haven't even heard of it. What the fuck
is that? It's the horror movie. It's Jordan Peele from Key and Peele directed it. It's a horror movie. It's about, mixed race couple goes to the white girl's family, and they're all like kind of your standard Swipple liberals. They love Obama and voted for him, and you know they love civil. You know they're all about your standard Democrat talking points. But what they do is they suck the brains out of blacks and put their own consciousness into them and take over their bodies, the black bodies.
No, just like Hollywood. Okay. Just for the record, for the listeners out there, Hunter is actually recording at Love Field Airport today. So
yes.
I'm sitting outside enjoying the spring weather. It's quite lovely.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, fair enough.
Okay. Yeah.
I thought that plane sounded a bit fucking close.
Yeah, no, I'm sitting outside, and then I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Going into Love Field, actually.
I saw Get Out. I thought it was all right.
Yeah, everybody I know saw it said it was pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know why. I don't know the title of it. It got renamed over here. That's why.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it got called Fuck Off. I got called. That's why Fuck Off and Get Out. That's why I've heard that a few times in my life.
it's supposed to be pretty good.
Fuck off and get out, cunt. That's right. Yeah.
Nah, you'd like it, Hunter. There's some big laughs in it.
Yeah, no. Everybody tells me I'd like it, so I'm going to see it eventually.
It's not Oscar quality. Well, I don't even know what that means anymore. But it's like
it has black people in it. John, it's got black people in it. It's an automatic nomination. Right. Yeah.
But as a genre film, I think it's better than a lot of what I've seen coming out of the horror genre in the last few years. Not that I see much of it.
No, I was going to say, there wouldn't be a great deal you have seen the last few years.
Yeah, I just avoid that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Anyway, get back to Decline 2.
So this movie, I think the Decline 1, I think both of these movies are highly hedonistic. But Decline 1 is kind of nihilistic with drugs and... The music is nihilistic, whereas this is more about hedonism.
Oh God, this is hedonism on steroids. This thing.
Yeah, this movie, it's all about sex and kind of that side. It's more about the party lifestyle. You know, you see your club owner, like your club owners in Decline 1. They're all sort of just your standard businessmen. In this one, you've got Ricky Rackman, former Loveline co-host Ricky Rackman.
Oh God,
and. And Headbangers Ball host Ricky Rackman, and you've got Ghazari or whatever the guy's name.
Oh God,
who's the sleaziest? These are the two ends of the sleaze spectrum right here.
Yeah.
But you interview a lot of the people, in the movie. I've noticed, the bands. I was kind of sitting there wondering why they don't have performances from. The bands that are big that are interviewed, like Aerosmith and Alice Cooper and Kiss and Ozzy. But I was kind of sitting there thinking a lot of those bands were big in the 70s. They were big when Decline 1 came out. And the bands that we see playing are bands that got big in the 80s.
Yeah.
Or not big. A lot of them never got.
Yeah,
some of them I don't think were ever
seen. I think the attitude would have been, we all know those bands. We know Alice. We know Kiss. We know...
They're all the influencers.
Exactly. You know? So we don't need to see performances by them. These are the up-and-comers coming through, potentially. Well,
Yeah, because they all, you see London and they live out of a RV barely, But the one that would get the biggest was Megadeth. And they're sort of seen as the band that's real and is about the music. And they don't talk about, even though Megadeth were all totally into drugs at the time. They're sort of the band that's not into just groupies and
I gotta say when I first saw this, the front cover of the VHS tape, I'm old, was so misleading because I'm like, oh, fucking tons of Megadeth. No, last 10 minutes, they're in there for the last 10 minutes.
You barely see Dave until the last 10 minutes of the movie are all Megadeth.
Yeah,
and it's the So Far So Good So What lineup.
Yeah, we are absolutely wiped out in heroin.
Yeah, it was pre-Marty Friedman and Nick Menza.
Yeah, the lineup that lasted all of, what, not even 12 months.
And what's kind of funny is it recreates some of the aesthetic of Decline Part 1, but updates it. You have the interviews in the room with the lone light bulb hanging down. Lemmy's interviewed against the LA freeway in the background in the same spot as that club owner and the or manager or whatever he was in the last movie. Ozzy is interviewed making breakfast, much like Darby Crash, and they faked that shot of him not being able to pour orange juice.
What a shame.
Which was hilarious. Hilarious, but not real. It was totally faked.
Yeah. But this was the most notorious of the three by far when it came in, and the most popular as well. You know, a lot as
when people talk about these movies, this is the one that gets talked about.
You know? Yeah, well, it was the one that got the widest release. It was actually released by a proper studio at the time, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, whereas I think if I remember correctly, Decline 1 was independent if it got released at all.
It was like an art house thing.
Yeah.
And, the third one wasn't even released, and it was just the second one was pushed heavy on cable TV on like clips would air on MTV and Night Flight, so it was kind of promoted there. So and also the videotape. I mean, really, people saw it on videotape. So, but the rental VHS was actually pretty widely released. It was out there. I think a major label actually released it, like RCA Columbia or somebody like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. But how many of the bands in here had you guys heard of before?
Familiar with? As far as the bands that played, I had heard of Lizzie Borden. I had heard of Faster Pussycat. And, of course, I knew Megadeth very well.
Yeah.
But Seduce, London, and Odin, never heard of any of those. If you listen to the commentary track on the Shout Factory Blu-ray, it's Penelope Spheris and Nadir De Priest, the front man of London, who's in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. But Lizzie Borden.
Well, I do want to say Lizzie Borden I had heard of, and Faster Pussycat was actually big for about 15 minutes in America.
Back Lizzie Borden, they just played in Dallas not too long ago with like LA Guns. You know?
Yeah, but they changed their sound. I was a Lizzie Borden fan from when did the Murderous Metal Roadshow live album come out? 86? Yeah, it would have been 86 I got into them. They're really weird. They had a EP, then a full-length album, then a double live album. So, anyway, that's when I got into them, the double live album and the Menace to Society album after that in 87. My sort of fandom for Lizzie Borden disappeared quick when they did the Visualize, I think it was. Yeah, but yeah, they fell away quick. Lizzie's one of those kind of like a Dee Snider type.
When I thought having them play a cover of Born to Be Wild, I was kind of thinking, I'm not getting a sense of their sound. I mean, I'm sure they sound like that. But, you know,
yeah, sure.
I was kind of going, I'm just hearing a cover. I don't, you know.
Maybe they couldn't get the rights musically to from Metal Blade, who was their label at the time. But, Lizzie Borden, I was familiar with Megadeth, obviously, and Faster Pussycat, as John said, was about the first album, I think was about it. I don't even think I like that first album a great deal anymore. I used to, but I don't care much for anything after that.
It sounded great back then. It sounded pretty good. And then, of course, nowadays, when we have access to so much stuff, like any New York Dolls album at the press of a button, why would you bother with Faster Pussycat?
Yeah, I prefer LA Guns, actually, around that time. Mm-hmm.
As far as the bands go, I think this one is weak, much weaker than Decline Part 1.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
I think where this one is entertaining is in the interviews and just the overall kind of just over-the-top degeneracy that's in it. And it's actually, I think a lot of the stuff in it, you know, it feels like it's making fun of a lot of it, you know, like the... It feels like Penelope Spheris is kind of making fun of a lot of these groups, a little bit, you know, you kind of get the sort of dumb Wayne's World vibe from it almost with all these sort of nobodies going, oh, I'm going to make it, you know? It's what other option is there?
I don't know nothing else in life, man. I can only make it. That's it. Well, we didn't. So, you know.
Yeah. I mean, we have it. It's not like Decline Part 1 where you're like, oh yeah, that Pat Smear guy's in the Foo Fighters now, you know?
Yeah.
These are all nobodies, pretty much. The big names are in the interviews, mostly. You see Aerosmith, Alice Cooper, and Kit. These architects of the sound we're hearing. And I got to say, though, I love how Penelope Spheeris sort of let them set up how their interviews were going to be. Paul Stanley in a bed of women. You can live like this if you want to.
Yeah, oh, God, what a beard. That was so retarded. He never looked gayer. Has anybody ever looked more like a homosexual surrounded by Playboy playmates? Yeah. Because I recognize that these are 80s Playboy playmates.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They're not his groupies. It's like, please.
No.
He's never looked like gayer.
He even talks about it in the book, though. He says that he made that whole thing up. He goes, the whole documentary is ridiculous. He goes, I'm just going to, turn up to 11 about how ridiculous I'm going to be. So it was never, it was a piss take. It was never meant to be serious, but I do agree with you, John.
Gray shopping with girls,
looking really like strange, like,
a lot of makeup on.
Kiss didn't really fit in with that scene as well as, no matter how hard they tried, they just could never really fit into that scene. Although they did have a couple of comeback hits.
Yeah, they. Paul Stanley said, people think of our 80s years as our lean years, but he said those years would make any band fat.
Yeah, Crazy Nights, and there were a couple of actual hits. I mean, they sound really awful nowadays.
God gave rock and roll to you too, as well. That still holds up well.
Yeah.
That Revenge album is pretty good. Bob Ezrin produced. Vinnie Vincent wrote a lot of it.
But Revenge was after that stuff kind of faded off.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, that's where God Gave Rock and Roll to You is from.
Yeah.
Oh, the Bill and Ted soundtrack, but off that album as well.
But the Ozzy breakfast interview was terrific. With Ozzy having his hair all done, too. Well, he's just dumping bacon and eggs and having a fry up.
Back then, he could be awake for at least half the day, so he still had his English wit to him, and unlike the mumbling kind of incomprehensible oaf he became.
Oh, he's hilarious! He's hilarious in this. So you're happier now that you're sober? No.
I always love what Iommi said on one of the Hard and Heavy video magazines about Ozzy. He was like, is the only man to go to the Betty Ford Clinic and then come out and say, can I have a drink? It's totally true. It's like,
oh, for sure.
And Alice is kind of sitting there with his props and looking very skinny. But Aerosmith was one that I thought was kind of bizarre in how just sort of just blatantly kind of frank they were about their hedonism. It was kind of funny.
They weren't quite as mainstream big at the time they made this as they were like just a year later. They blew up super huge and were arguably the biggest rock band in the country at the time.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Pump was a monster. Like, you couldn't get away from it. And I think this is right before Pump came out.
Yeah. I just picked up Joe Perry's book the other day. $6 for the hardback. I can't wait to get into it.
It's a decent read. I read it.
I've heard nothing but good things about it. Like, it was really candid, and Perry doesn't hold back on something. So
it was really good. I did the signing at the Barnes & Noble in New York.
Yeah, you know.
With Joe.
Yeah, what I like about Joe is he's a conservative. He's just as conservative as Ted Nugent.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I just read that the other day.
At Ted's property. Like, they go target shooting and stuff.
Yeah, I just read about Joe Perry being a huge conservative online. So, yeah, very cool. That's why I put the picture up of him with the woke eyes. Because why not?
It's fitting. Yeah. I mean, when I saw Aerosmith back in 89... he was cool as hell. He's one of the coolest guitarists I've seen live.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. I just started listening to some of the Joe Perry Project as well from the 79, 1990 album. And, man, it's pretty good. I'm really impressed how good it is.
Yeah, it's definitely not bad considering that time period. But he said he made those albums as sort of a response to punk rock because he liked the energy and punk records at the time. And it's definitely got that sound.
Yeah.
Well, I got to say, like, when I was young, Aerosmith was the band of the Armageddon soundtrack. You know, like the dance song at our homecoming dances was "Don't Want to Close My Eyes."
Well,
you know,
we were showing just, your age, boy. That time.
No, I mean that's kind of the Aerosmith I grew up with was you know that stuff.
No,
not when I go back and listen to 70s Aerosmith, I'm like, whoa.
it's cool. A bit of a difference. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was introduced to them as the band that was in, they were the evil rock band and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band movie with the Bee Gees. Cause that played on HBO like all the time back in 1980.
Oh
my gosh.
And that's how their cameo or their small role is one of the highlights, one of the only highlights of the movie. Because they did come together, and it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, that was on the Armageddon soundtrack.
What would you say? Hey, John, what would you say is the best Aerosmith album of the early ones?
I love Toys in the Attic. It's pretty hard to deny, but I like Get Your Wings. And, you know, when I go back and listen to them, I'll say, oh, this is my favorite. And then I'll listen to another one from that era, and I'm like, no, wait, this is my favorite. Like, they're really consistently great.
Man, that 1-2-3 punch of Get Your Wings, Rocks, and Toys in the Attic is fucking
rock. Rocks might be it. Rocks is fantastic, but I have to go back and listen to them again to...
But I agree. You can listen to Toys in the Attic and go, no, this is the best. Then you go back and get Your Wings, no, this is probably the best. And then Rocks, and yeah, it's... I mean, I even like Night in the Ruts a bit as well.
It's not bad at all.
It's not bad. I mean, it's got some cracking tracks on there, but as good as the early ones, no. But you know, I still enjoy it. But what about Odin? What about the legend that is Odin?
Oh, that guy with his assless chaps. I couldn't. He's kind of this Tom Kiefer, Axl Rose sound-alike guy. You know, like he has that scratchy cat being tortured voice.
Yeah.
But for me, I was always thinking, oh, that's the band with the guy from Armored Saint.
Yeah.
Because I think he replaced the guy who died of cancer in Armored Saint.
He did, yeah. I think by the time this was released, this documentary, he said he was already signed up and joined Armored Saint. So he tried to block out his Odin appearance in this documentary for many, many
very
years.
Very much an upgrade, you know?
Yeah, even though I've gone off Armored Saint quite a bit because of their massive lefty politics and...
Oh, yeah. Their albums have a big...
When you name an album La Raza, I think you know where the fuck they stand.
Oh, yeah. Karl Marx was all about metal, sure.
Yeah, really.
He was all about hair metal and rock and roll.
But, you know, I do want to talk about... Maybe I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but... Chris Holmes, Wasp. You know, Blackie Lawless has come up a lot on this show. He's not in this movie, but, no. You know, that's his band.
No, he wasn't in this movie, but he was in Can't Stop the Music.
And he was in the New York Dolls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I saw him at Chiller Con back in 96, looking like he was terrified that anybody would recognize him without all this get up on.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. A friend of mine spotted him. And go, hey, there's Blackie Lawless, a Wasp. And it was. He was wearing like a denim jean jacket, but, you know, the hair and the face was unmistakable. But
yeah.
He was just trying to he was trying to get out of there before anybody knew who he was. And a friend spotted him right away.
Now, I gotta say, I do like Wasp quite a bit.
I like patches of him. I wouldn't say if I went through all the discography, I was, you know, a fan of him overall. I like the first one. I think the first one is a true, genuine hard rock classic.
Oh, the first Wasp album is a rock and roll classic. I love it.
The Last Command. Great. I remember picking it up when it came out. I just go, I don't get where they're going. I do like it now quite a bit.
It's good.
Blackie was obviously ahead of me when he was doing the album. But
the first one is very raw, and the second one is very produced. So it's kind of a jump.
But my favorite Wasp song is not even on the album. It's the B-side to Animal, which was Show No Mercy. I really liked that a lot. I mean, it eventually found its way onto the first album as bonus tracks, but I was always shocked it was never on the first album. I thought it was fucking great.
And,
Let's go back. Blackie Lawless was also in that film. Was it Dragon Slayer or something? Is the Wasp or the metal band on stage?
Oh, he was in some. Yeah, he was in something. I can't remember what band.
Was it the Dungeon Master?
Dungeon Master. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the Empire releases or whatever.
That's it. Because they actually put Blackie's face on the video, on the VHS tape. I'm like, oh, Blackie Lawless film. But, yeah, he wasn't in it very long.
But I like, you know, I think Inside the Electric Circus is a fun album. But, you know, The Headless Children is one I like quite a bit.
It's very good.
That was,
yes.
Yeah, that was the one, that was right before Chris Holmes left for the first time.
For some reason, you guys just reminded me that there's this 1982 horror film with John Cassavetes called The Incubus. And
oh, yeah,
in England. And the band in the film is Samson with Bruce Dickinson on vocals.
Yes.
Really?
And it's on Amazon Prime. I'm going to watch it just to see the Samson cameo. But
Yeah. I've got some Samson on vinyl. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Have you? They're not that good.
Yeah. I've got pretty much everything Iron Maiden on vinyl. I've got all of Bruce Dickinson solo on vinyl, and I've got some Samson on vinyl. So I've got a lot.
Can't get those on CD though, Hunter.
It's the best format. Yeah. Can't listen to it in your car.
You CDs. You got all the Paul Di'Anno solo stuff on vinyl, like Battle Zone.
I do not.
Yeah, don't bother.
Paul Di'Anno.
Fuck that fat idiot, man. I was watching. My brother over last night, we're watching Paul Di'Anno wheel out in a fucking wheelchair because he goes, oh, I can't stand it. I've got to have a knee operation shortly because I'm not going to go home, sit at home, cry about it, come out, rock out with you, friends. And it's fucking bad, man. It's like, he's playing in Japan to about maybe less than 100 people. He's got a Japanese backing band just playing Maiden songs. He wheels out in a wheelchair. He's trying to rock out in the wheelchair. It's Oh, God, it's serious.
Oh, that sounds sad.
We were just fucking crawling on the floor laughing. It was that bad, just for the fact that he was this fat slob. And oh, God. And he's berating the band. He's berating the Japanese band, like, oh, why are you playing so low? I can't hear you, you bunch of pussies. And one guy is about playing guitar, is about to walk off. I thought, this is a debacle, mate.
Oh, it's terrible.
Jesus, Di'Anno, just go.
Kick his wheelchair off the stage.
Oh,
could you get more metal than that? That looked like something out of one of those Empire movies. Those releases like the Dungeon Masters.
Even my brother goes, this is fucking worse than Spinal Tap. Pretty much.
That's our go-to reference for everything bad and metal and hard rock, I think, is Spinal Tap.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It really should be bad news, seeing as that predated Spinal Tap by 2 years, but it just never got the fame and notoriety that Spinal Tap did. But yeah, anyway.
Yeah. I supposedly when Ozzy saw Spinal Tap, he's like, I thought they were a real band.
Yeah, he's like, the getting lost backstage happened
That's
to be
us.
All the time.
That was us.
No, you hear bands say that all the time, that movie's too real.
Yeah.
You know? I think Saxon said that some of it was based on them as well.
Uriah Heep was actually a huge inspiration.
They're playing here pretty soon.
Oh, God, are they?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Mick
Box must be pushing 70 odd now, I think.
They all look pretty old.
Yeah. So does Biff Byford, but he can still kick out a jam or two. Easily.
Yeah, Biff, last time I saw Saxon with UFO, they were awesome. They're
with who?
I saw him with UFO, my favorite band.
Yeah. Yes, I was waiting.
I liked them in high school. Nobody else did, but I didn't care.
I had a sticker on my car, and people tried to run me off the road.
Probably because I thought he was a UFO Area 51.
Yeah. It was Alex Jones.
Yeah.
It's the globalists.
Yeah, they thought he was an Art Bell type guy. They thought he was an Art Bell fanatic or something. What a twit. But, you know, I noticed Vixen was interviewed in the documentary, and the funny thing is they actually had they were like a one-hit wonder.
Yeah, they were.
The Edge of the Broken Dream or whatever their hit was, but I remember being for 10 minutes for a cup of coffee.
Yeah. You know damn well the guys were just going out to see Vixen for Vixen. They didn't care about the music.
Yeah, they were pretty good looking for the Czech band that played metal.
Like the female singer of Femme Fatale. I've forgotten her name, but no one really cared what she sang like. It's...
Or what's her name? Doro or
no? That's Doro Pesh from Warlock. No, this is somebody else.
Yeah, Doro's from Warlock.
But she has a following though. I've had like I'll be buying CDs and somebody will ask me, "Did you see Doro?"
She's still got a following. She played in Dallas not too long ago.
Man, that woman, has not aged. I don't know how she does it, but she looks the same she did back in 87 when she was with Warlock.
She still looks good. Yeah. Oh, yeah. She's taking care of herself.
Yeah. Good luck to her. She ages better than some others.
Don't smoke and drink, and you'll look all right.
Basic. Yeah, Paul Diano, you listening? You fat slob.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and don't eat like crap, too.
Yeah. You'll age like Chris Isaac, as long as you stay healthy.
Yeah, there's a guy who sold his soul, I tell you. My goodness, what is he, like 62 or something, 61? And
something like that. I've seen him close up, like when he was in his 50s and he played Red Rocks, and it's like, there's not a wrinkle on his face.
No, there's not. No, there's really not. I think
it doesn't look like plastic surgery. It just looks like he hasn't aged.
No, he's a very clean living guy from memory. He does a lot of physical activity and also eats right. So, yeah, it does help. Yeah. I don't think he drinks either. If he does, it's very, very minimal.
He plays sexy music, too, which is supposed to be good for your skin.
That helps.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, but he does not drink. Doesn't drink or smoke.
Unlike Lemmy.
Yeah, who's dead.
Everybody would always go, oh, Lemmy, you know, he drinks and smokes, and here he is. But he was dead.
He's
before
dead.
70.
Yeah.
Lemmy hit a wall pretty quick. Like, I always thought he was older than
he
actually was.
He always looked horrible. You know, he always looked like he was pushing 70. Yeah.
Right.
Now he's pushing something else. Oh, it's daisies. That's right.
Yeah.
Poor cunt. All right.
But yeah, the thing that made the you know, because Penelope Spheeris said that all the interviewees kind of came up with what they wanted for the interview. Like Paul Stanley was like, I want to sit in a bed of supermodels. Gene Simmons said, I want to go lingerie shopping. Chris Holmes said, I want to be drunk in a pool with my mom. And that's the thing about that interview that makes it weird is Chris Holmes's mom is sitting there.
Yet it is exactly what everybody remembers about that movie.
Yeah.
That's the first thing they bring up. It's like, so he apparently had a good mind for marketability there.
And apparently, Penelope Spheeris said that he was very upset with how it turned out, but I think that's just because people were horrified by it.
That's all anybody talked about.
Yeah, You know, it seemed really hilarious, I'm sure, in his mind, but when it comes
it's obvious it's fake because he's like guzzling pool water, clearly. It's just like with David Lee Roth allegedly drinking Jack Daniels on stage and supposedly it was iced tea.
It was iced tea, Yeah,
and then David Lee Roth makes that joke that the Clash does that or whatever. So it was the great line. But, you know, there's always an amount of a work to all of that stuff. Like, Alice Cooper's not really chopping his head off on stage. It's like it's
no?
all kind of contrived.
Shit, I thought he was.
Yeah,
I thought he's had a really good surgeon.
He was the one Highlander who was.
Yeah, it's like the easiest illusion in the world, and it's funny that they even bother. But, oh, well.
Alice's neck is so skinny you could chop it off with a piece of cardboard.
Yeah. Well, he benefited by always looking kind of like a skinny, ugly guy. So when he aged, it didn't really matter.
Became an older, skinny, ugly guy. Yeah.
He's, you know, nowadays he opens for Motley Crue when they're retiring and they're, you know, younger than he is.
Well, speaking of someone who looks like death, poor Mick Mars. I'm surprised he's still walking around.
Doesn't he have a bunch of health, like, diseases, though? Not, like, STDs or anything, but doesn't he have, like, lupus or something? I don't know.
Yeah, I think he's got lupus, something like that.
He's got some disease that, you know, makes him, you know, not look so good.
So is Tommy Lee. He's got a disease. It's called being a dickhead.
Yeah.
He's a moron. Oh. He's a total moron.
Oh, he is.
I think this movie was kind of trying to cap. I think it does a good job of sort of capturing what the LA scene was like, because it was a lot of in the 80s. It was a lot of these hair metal bands that were living off girlfriends and, you know, they put forth this glamorous image, but they were sort of living a similar lifestyle to the punks and the first movie. But the image they were putting forth was different. It was supposed to be, you know, theatrical and glamorous.
Punks would have been flat broke and look like it. Whereas the metalheads, the hair metalers, would have been just as broke, but they tried their damnedest to look like they were rich.
Exactly.
So it was a complete opposite to the punkers.
And, you know, both of the scenes are nihilistic, but one is this one is kind of sexually, you know, it's hedonistic. Mm. It's more no future nihilism in the future in the first movie. But this movie, I think it does, even though you kind of look at it and you go, okay, I'm seeing a bunch of bands I don't care about, like Seduce and Odin in London. But you are kind of getting an authentic look into what the LA scene was like. It wasn't all these bands like, you know, if you watch the Metal Evolution episode on 80s hair metal, you know, you get the bands that are successful, like
Poison.
Motley Crue, Poison. Yeah. You know, at Poison, that's another band that's in this movie. Although they're not featured as a performance, they're interviewed in it.
Yeah, but by 89, they were already massive. So
yeah, they were huge. Mm. But so you get the successful bands, but you also get the ones that are struggling and sort of living day to day. And I think it is sort of a interesting look into that scene that you wouldn't otherwise get from a, you know, more of a VH1 style.
Oh no, that would bury that shit. You know, just it'd be the old hard luck story, like, oh man, I went and delivered papers for, you know, $8 a day sort of shit. But yeah, you wouldn't see the sort of debauch.
But I do think one thing you did get from Metal Evolution, though, was you got Poison being honest about their promotion tactics, which they didn't discuss in this, was Ricky Rocket saying that they would do this thing where they would advertise free beer or something. Yeah. They did stuff that they had basically handouts, you know, beer and stuff at shows. They had these tactics that they would do to attract people to their shows away from other shows that's, you know, helped build their following.
Yeah.
I did think about that while I was watching it. Because it's way after the fact, whereas this was kind of down in the trenches, I guess.
Oh, the funny thing about Poison is they marketed themselves to rednecks in flyover country extremely effectively.
And how do they do that? Because they all look like chicks, you know?
You know, those ballad stuff, like Every Rose Has a Thorn, was just huge and was played on rock radio in flyover country. Album-oriented rock stations are a bit different. They'll play a lot of Motley Crue ballads and Poison and Bon Jovi. And even though I remember Bon Jovi being marketed to little girls when they started.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I specifically remember that because my sister was into them. And she was only 10 at the time or something. And like Runaway and those type of songs. But Poison, what they did was they did the Kiss method. They basically toured and always consistently played in coliseums and arenas across the country. Didn't matter where the market was, in the middle of farmland, and built a following that way. Because when I was living in Mississippi, no bands hardly ever played the Jackson Coliseum every year. We were just not a concert stop for anybody except Poison. Poison played every year. And they just kept it consistent.
They were prolific, even to this day, you see Bret Michaels or Poison, if they are reformed, they're just always doing some live show somewhere, which, I mean, you got to
they played what you call the county fair market, some might say. And I think he even tried to crack the country pop charts.
He did. Bret Michaels did, like, Every Rose Has Its Thorn with Miley Cyrus before she got totally, you know,
messed up,
degenerate. Yeah.
Yeah. Degenerate whore, basically. I mean, that crowd still buys records. The country music crowd still buys CDs. They're supporting.
Oh, yeah. The they still buy Taylor Swift albums, even though she's not country anymore.
Right. Rock fans are like, I'll just download an MP3. Yeah. They don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aren't they stopping the manufacturing of CDs shortly?
Didn't I hear something? I hadn't heard that.
No? I haven't heard. I think that's a rumor. Yeah. I've heard that Best Buy is going to quit selling them.
Okay.
Yeah, some major stores are not going to sell them anymore, but I don't think that. I think they're cheap enough to produce that you can still get them on Amazon or whatever.
I think Amazon's probably the bulk of their sales anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Even though
ordered
Amazon.
The new Andrew WK, you know.
if you want the new Odin, you know, you just
go to Amazon. You get yourself.
I wonder what happened to that guy, Odin. I wonder what happened to him.
What happened to Seduce?
Seduce, yeah. Wasn't the guy in Seduce, didn't he own the cat house with Ricky Rackman?
Yeah, oh, I probably did. I think he did.
This whole thing smacks of like nepotism and a crew member knew the band.
Oh, no, he was in Faster Pussycat. Never mind.
I was okay.
Whoops.
That describes this documentary in one word. Whoops.
Whoops. Oops. Yeah, the thing about the movie, that the part of the movie that's really gross, that's hard to sit through, is the Ghazari, you know, dance
good
section.
Jesus.
That part of the movie is just, it's so sleazy, you need to take a shower afterward.
Oh, no, I enjoyed watching him. I mean, don't get me wrong, but himself, yeah, like that Ghazari himself. So,
well, that's why I think if you watch that if you just, okay, let's say you just zeroed in on that Ghazari scene and the way that the band members and the audience were reacting to the girls and stuff, that's exactly why grunge got huge.
Yeah, it probably was. Yeah.
The scene was extremely alienating to female listeners. And, you know, also young guys that may not be into, you know, going to something like that and rooting on these big-haired women to do that stuff. It's a weird thing. You know, that's why grunge just got so huge so quick and pretty much annihilated this whole scene.
Do you guys think this documentary was pretty much the final nail in the coffin for hair metal? Because it really did no favors once it came out.
I don't think it was the final nail because, you know, it lasted about 4 more years, right? I mean,
not that long.
About 91,
92. 91,
yeah.
Yeah,
91, 92 is kind of when it...
It was dead, yeah. But didn't this get a release until about 90, something like that, 89?
Most people saw it in 90, I think, if they saw it at the video store and rented it.
Yeah.
If it did well on video, that would have been it.
But no, I don't think it was the final nail in the coffin, but I think it was one of the things that helped contribute to its demise.
Didn't help. It didn't help. Yeah,
It was a sign on the road this shit wasn't going to last much longer.
It's bad PR. In my opinion, you watch it and you go, you know.
Well, the scene in LA was just so saturated. I mean, I remember it. Of course, I wasn't there, but I remember certainly reading about it in magazines and other forms of, you know, information you get out there. And it was one band after another, after another, after another. And it was just insane. You couldn't keep up. There was Brittany Fox and Poison, and it's, you know, you buy one album and another 10 would come out. It's like a mice infestation. you got one, there's going to be another 10 floating around somewhere as well. But it just became oversaturated. And that was the record company's fault as well. They were a big part of this getting killed off. I mean,
oh yeah,
not that I really think they gave a shit. It was just they just wanted their money. But
Also think there was something to Guns N' Roses not following up Appetite for Destruction with another album within 2 years.
You think so?
Because I think that was a factor. Because they looked like they were going to be the new Rolling Stones, and they very well could have been. But they were just so, you know, the releases were delayed, and every time you'd walk into the record store, rumors were they had broken up. It was just like, it was constant. And then when they finally put out Use Your Illusion 1 and 2, it wasn't really worth the wait. Like, nah. That's something you just put out the next year after Appetite for Destruction. That's not something you wait, like, 4 years for.
Nah, no way. But 4 years is nothing
They
Chinese
still
democracy.
Pull those big, fat stadium tours, though. I mean, my goodness.
Because people just want to hear Appetite for Destruction.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, the parts where they played Use Your Illusion and... what's that? Chinese Democracy. Whenever they played stuff from that, it's sort of dead. Like, everybody wanted the Appetite songs.
They want
Rocket Queen. They don't want that shit.
That's right. They want Rocket Queen. They want Welcome to the Jungle. They want Night Train. They want, you know, more stuff from Appetite. They don't really care for November Rain. They don't want 10 minutes of, you know, Wank. That's just, yeah.
Yeah. Axel thinking he's Elton John, who didn't really have the songwriting ability of Elton and Bernie.
What else you guys got taken from this? Yeah, it was... I mean, I enjoy this documentary, don't get me wrong. I give it a solid score, but as I said last week, I don't think I'm going to give it as good a score as Part 1. Part 1 was far, far more interesting to me, even though I love my hard rock, my metal, and all that. But
Well, the music is consistently better in the first one. Like,
yeah, I
those
agree.
Those bands had long careers, like Circle Jerks and X.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, true.
Well, X is huge a few years later. They got
the only one that had a long career. I mean, Faster Pussycat. I mean, not Faster Pussycat. Lizzie Borden, Faster Pussycat. Those bands are still around somewhat, I think.
Yeah,
Pussycat played the bar down the street from me that I could just walk to. I should have gone. Just for the hell of it.
Lizzie Borden had a bit of a checkered career because they went through to about 95 or something, then split up, then reformed again.
As a lot
split
of bands
up
did
and
in those
get
years.
Reformed. Yeah, yeah. And
well,
now
they
Lizzie
kept thinking grunge would fall over, and it wasn't. It wouldn't die. Like, it just influenced another generation. These hair metal guys were lost.
Yeah, they didn't know what to do with themselves. Some dipped their toe in the grunge pool, and it didn't work. Glenn Danzig, I'm looking at you, with that horrible Black Acid Devil album.
Pantera probably made the most successful.
I think Pantera was kind of the band for metalheads that kind of transitioned over to sort of the the beer and. Weed crowd.
they have spawned a look that I absolutely despise. When I went and saw Overkill Friday night, I saw that many fucking beards in there. I swear I thought I was like in an Amish commune or something. It was ridiculous. I thought this looks gone. It's just it looks fucking stupid. You know, the old King Tut beards. It looks dumb.
Shaved head and King Tut beard.
Oh, yeah. Anyway. Like Paul Di'Anno. I keep coming back to Paul Di'Anno because I can't get that fucking image out of my head from him in the wheelchair. And oh, God. Yeah. But, yeah, just like bald heads or you know, just like big King Tut beard. It looks stupid. Just looks stupid. Oh, and that little cunt at the concert on Friday night, he decided to clip me in the back of the head because I pushed him. Fuck off. Next time I'll knock you out. Asshole.
But, you know, Megadeth is the only band that's kind of gone on to have a long, successful career, really.
And they feel like an afterthought in this documentary. It's like, oh, we're about 10 minutes short. Okay.
We need credibility.
Pretty much.
That's kind of what it was. And Dave even said that he felt he was being put in with inferior groups in the
movie. Well, he was.
he totally was.
He was very right. He was very woke.
Dave was a visionary back then, even. I need to go back and listen to some of these bands because I just want to actually hear what they really sound like. Because, I mean, you don't get much of them. You get a lot. A lot of this is all just talking heads, really. There's not a great deal of music in it. It's got a lot less music in it compared to the first one, anyway. When you get long sequences of Fear and X and all that.
It's got more TNA than the other two combined.
Yeah, can't complain about that.
It's got more TNA than all of Penelope Spheris' movies combined.
Yeah,
pretty much. Yeah. Did I tell you all I watched Dudes?
No.
You posted about it. I've never seen it.
It's this movie with Flea and Lee Ving and John Cryer.
Oh, Lord. Are you serious?
Yeah, it's this movie she did. It was barely released, and it's written by the guy who wrote The Doors for Oliver Stone. And it has John Densmore in it, too.
Oh, my God.
But it's about these punk guys. It has the Vandals in it as well.
God.
Yeah, it was actually kind of a fun flick. It's about these... these punk guys from New York who decide they're going to go west to California. And on their way, they get bushwhacked by, you know, these sort of biker types played. Their leader is Lee Ving, of course.
Yeah, of course.
And you know, they kill the Flea character. And so John Cryer and his other buddy, I forget the guy who plays him, but they're these punk guys, and they go after them, and they sort of LARP as cowboys and Indians while they chase them. God. But it was a pretty fun kind of one of those weird 80s punk movies, kind of like Suburbia, except more funny and more genre mixy, you know, than that.
I like The Boys Next Door, the one with Charlie Sheen and Max like going on a killing spree.
That Boys Next Door, that I haven't seen it, but I've heard it's good.
It actually is. I saw it on cable back in the 80s and was really surprised at the time how good it was.
Yeah, we should hit that one up sometime.
Yeah, maybe might be worth a look.
Can you actually
but,
get
Dude?
Can you get
Dudes came out on Shout Select, so that one's worth checking out. I thought it was fun.
Okay. Can you get Suburbia? Can you see that anywhere?
Yeah. Okay. I have it on DVD.
Oh, okay. Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah. And Flea's in that one too. And it's got a DI and some of these other bands in it too. You know, there's a lot of extended punk performance sequences in it.
I need to see it. I mean, I've seen some of her other films, like what was it, Mikhail's Navy?
No. Yeah, she made some bad movies like Beverly Hillbillies and
she was doing merc work. She was like, that stuff pays, you know. It was like, that's real mercenary directing stuff.
Oh, totally.
Merc work.
She probably went to debt financing these movies, and so she had to do stuff like Beverly Hillbillies just to make a fortune and probably, you know, pay her house off.
I think Wayne's World got her a lot of that, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that was a big meal ticket, I think.
She didn't have to do the sequel. That's how much money she made. So
yeah, oh, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, overall, I enjoy this movie. I think it's fun to watch. But you know, watching it, I always thought this one was the one I enjoyed more. But I think I enjoy the first one more.
Yeah,
yeah,
I do as well.
Well, these bands have no relevance for me, and I don't like the scene. I don't.
Yeah, the only one for me is Megadeth. That's it.
Yeah,
I will say that the Blu-ray of this does look outstanding. It looks really,
yeah,
really
it does.
Clear.
Yeah, it looks great.
I watched it on the Shout TV Roku app. No commercials, and that's a commercial, usually a commercial interruption.
Oh.
Roku, and this had no commercials.
Oh, nice one.
Maybe there's certain selections where they don't even bother. So that was interesting.
Oh, if you boys got nothing else, you want to rate this thing?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, Stuart, what do you think?
I'm going to give this look, for all its failings and all the bands and all the, you know, talking themselves up and they got nowhere, I'm going to give this an 8 still. I enjoyed it. As much as the first one, no, but I do like this one quite a bit. And would I recommend it? Yes, I would, for sure. So, yeah, it's an 8 from me.
All right, John, what do you give it?
I give it a 7. I hate the music, but it's a very... You know, a lot of it's fake. A lot of it's worked for the camera. However, I mean, it does its job, which is basically presenting that documentary view of that scene at the time. It's pretty accurate. It's not a lot of exaggeration. I remember that scene and remember following this stuff in the magazines and being disappointed when I actually heard these bands that were hyped up to me by the magazines. Yeah, I mean, it's well worth a look. And like I said, if you're one of these that thinks that, and I know these people, they think hair metal was this great lost scene that was killed by grunge unfairly, and it was a big plot and all that stuff. It's like, no. You watch this, you see exactly why that scene died.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think it kind of illustrates it pretty well, the problems in there.
Yeah, a lot of problems. If you got a like a singer talking about his dick for like 5 minutes, you know, why wouldn't hard rock fans decide to listen to rap instead at the time?
Yeah, it seems this scene where a lot of people are trying to self-aggrandize their sexuality, and it's
annoying. It's like, you know, you're not all Andrew Dice Clay, and there's a joke there, you know, that you guys aren't in on, apparently.
Yeah, exactly.
These are the guys who took dice literally.
Well, I'd give it a 7 as well, and I kind of amend my rating of the last one, because I actually like it more. I enjoy this movie. You know, I gave the last one a 6, but, you know, I think I'd give that one a 7.5.
Yeah.
I wanted Lee Ving to come in and, like, chew all these guys out.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of yell at them.
1989, can't you get a fucking haircut?
Yeah, can't you get a haircut?
What are you, a queer?
Read the disclaimer in a German accent.
Yeah!
But yeah, no, I'd give it a 7. I think it's a really, if you want a really honest time capsule look at the hair metal era, that's warts and all, this is a good one to kind of show why this needed to be destroyed.
It was asking for it.
Yeah, it really was. That's true.
They were all asking for it. They were all asking to have their scene destroyed.
It's their own damn fault.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know what we're going to do next week, but, you know, I don't know if we tell you that normally, so I don't think we do. But, you know, email us at MidnightMovieCowboys@gmail.com, MidnightMovieCowboys. Join us on Facebook. We've got the discussion group. It's a lot of fun. Go check us out there. But, yeah, you know, if you want to see this movie, you can watch it. Shout Factory has it on Blu-ray. I'm sure there's other avenues to watch it as well. I'm not really sure. But the box set of all these movies is worth checking out. I don't know if we're going to do the third one or not. The third one's more about homeless kids than music. Yeah. And no, none of the bands in it are relevant at all.
Nope.
Yeah.
So, you know, it may not elicit good discussion. It's just going to be...
If the bands in part two were irrelevant, part three makes them look like fucking Led Zeppelin and Aerosmith. So.
Yeah.
I still look like Woodstock.
Yeah, the Seduce looks like, you know, it looks like Monterey Pop levels of success.
Montreux Festival.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, Ted Nugent at a California Jam.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, but all the movies are worth checking out, even the third one.
Well, it comes in the box. You can only get these available in the box, so you're going to get all three anyway.
Yep. Yeah. So it's a box set worth getting, in my opinion. So anyway, I think that's it for this week. Next week we'll be back with something else. I don't know what we'll be doing something, but for now I'm just going to go ahead and say adios.
I will say mega.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.